You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, we're talking with Craig Smith. Craig, thanks for being with me today.
You bet. Thanks for having me.
So, Craig, I want to talk about your work, and I guess I'd like to jump into this by just asking you what are you working on now, and I'm going to want to get into some of the issues that your work's touching on. So can you tell me a little bit about just what you're occupied with at the moment in Florida?
Sure.
Right? You're in Florida?
Yeah, I'm based at the University of Florida, and I run the lens-based imaging and photography program here in the School of Art and Art History. I've been here since about 2010 and came here from London at that time. I've been in London for about 7 years at the Goldsmiths and the LCC. And since that time, and while I've been here, I've been working through a lot of projects dealing with, or I guess kind of emerging from some of the work that came out in the early 2000s around relational aesthetics. But then I've been attempting to kind of look at that in relationship to convivial encounters and what takes place in contrast to representation and media imaging. So I'm working on a book with a group out of London called IB Taurus, and the book will be called Relational Art, A Guided Tour, and hopefully we'll get it out here in 2016. And then I'm working on a series of photography is really the basis and performance art are the basis of my museum and gallery practices. And I'm working with a group that are in Boston and Chicago right now called Column Health. And we've started a group called Column Culture, which is dealing with addiction. And my task that we're putting together with for Column Health as Column Culture is to create and build out installations of new photographic and interactive and time-based media that will actually go into, or is now actually in place in Boston, in clinics where people are being treated for different types of addiction and treated with pharmaceuticals that are not mainstream pharmaceuticals in the sense that it's not people going down to the methadone clinic, but people actually taking something called Suboxone, which has been on the market for a long time, but is not readily available. So part of what I'm doing is not art therapy.
But what is, just to get that detail, what is Suboxone? Yeah. That's in place of methadone?
Yeah, so Suboxone is supposedly a non-addictive cure for opiate addiction. So whereas methadone is supplements opiate addiction, so you're not shooting pills or heroin anymore.
Yeah, but methadone is supposed to be harder to get off of than heroin.
Exactly. So Suboxone is something that, along with psychiatric therapy, should ideally cure patients of their addiction. And this group is out of Boston. Some folks that have formerly worked with the federal government, and others that have worked in private medical practices. And I think their interest in working with me is to see how, say, coming out of relational aesthetics, how do these ideas of collective engagement, ideas of site specificity, ideas of location-based identity, how can they be distributed or disseminated through a clinic that has a very clear mandate that they've posed to themselves? And, you know, how can the work actually operate actively as a verb inside those clinics rather than as an object or a point of connoisseur?
Well, as an educational tool, really, also. I mean, is it this is a great way to talk about not only your work but also relational aesthetics, because, you know, there's all that theory, which I'd like to talk about because maybe a lot of our listeners don't know that much about relational aesthetics. But so you're working with addicts, this is really like applied art also. Beyond all the issues that we could talk about, your art is being, and just correct me if I'm wrong, but it's being commissioned, it's by this health agency, essentially, or it's a collaboration. And, you know, they're valuing your skills and ability to create something physical that's going to interact and support their mission, which is to get people off drugs, right?
Yeah. You know, and I think that's a very kind of accurate way of describing it. I would also describe it as almost working curatorially, because I think that regardless of the images that I create, what we're trying to do is create a certain type of experience in those spaces. And so because of some of that theoretical work and some of the underpinnings around human interactivity and relational aesthetics, the idea of the event and of artwork and the experience of audiences and art objects and the artists themselves coming together at unique moments in time and space, that these clinics then operate as a substitute for a museum or gallery. So for Column Health, I agree with you. It's an applied, it's using artist practices that are otherwise deemed for galleries and museums or publications.
But in a very sophisticated way. I mean, I interview artists from all over the world, and you hear about some things like this happening in Europe sometimes. Institutions realizing, you know, artists cannot just hang work on their walls or make the place look better, but the way they think and research and explore can actually help their mission. It seems unusual for the United States even.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, and it works, I think, for me, productively, and hopefully for, you know, my contemporaries and some of my students, it's a productive way of working that learns from and responds to the commercial gallery system, but is not a subordinate to the commercial gallery system. So I think that the commercial gallery system is a good way of defining aesthetics and aesthetic turns, and also, obviously, there's a lot of amazing people through which the gallery system is their main conduit or vehicle to engage audiences and collectors. But there's so many things available in which we can define the potential of, again, I'll use your term, the application of aesthetics, and maybe even, Brainerd, the application of philosophy. Or, you know, kind of doing philosophy in practice. And certainly it's not original for me to try to apply those ideas. This is pretty hot stuff, again, in Europe and through Kingston University and Georgia Tech here in the United States. But I find it quite fascinating. And, you know, maybe I'm in a lucky position where I don't have to, where I can work off of commissions rather than creating commercial art objects. That might give me a certain kind of dynamic or flexibility that might otherwise, you know, it might be unique compared to other situations.
Absolutely. It's a dynamic you see in Europe. You see people, I talked to a guy who moved from Paris to, you know, Amsterdam because he got a 2-year residency, everything paid. I mean, you know, there's lifestyle seems to be that way more. But to continue about this project, you talk about the experience, right? All this is created for a specific experience. It's not just a gallery or museum within this setting. It's an experience. So what is the experience you're trying to have? Because it feels like this is actually, and just correct me if I'm wrong, but a transformative experience. You'd like there to be insight. There's other aspects to addiction, I would imagine, than purely the chemical. There's also, but you tell me, what is the experience that is trying to be created or is created?
Yeah, and I'm not trying to escape the question, but I think that it's a unique experience per patient. And I think that obviously for Column Health, the idea is, you know, a successful patient therapist engagement, a successful patient practitioner engagement, which would be people, you know, no longer shooting drugs, for example. I think for me, it's the ability for the staff at these clinics, for the medical practitioners, for the psychiatric therapist, and for the patients, and for perhaps any of their contemporaries who are coming in doing similar types of work or looking for other ways to actually work and help people with these particular issues rather than simply make money or, you know, maybe do both at the same time, that they see these as active spaces that are not just brick and mortar. And so I think that experience should be one where the individual works hanging on the wall or the individual build-outs of video, et cetera, they're not really being looked at as decoration or adornment to this space, but really as kind of motivating features. And, you know, rather than, let's say, representations of successful treatment, they're a part of the therapeutic process, but for the individual experience of the persons who are using those spaces. And, I would count the staff, the therapists and the practitioners, as well as the patients, as being part of that overall model, that comprehensive model.
Okay, that makes sense. But now, tell me what is on those monitors and what is in those images. What I mean, I know the experience is supposed to, and that's clear from what you're saying, kind of carry forth and work in unison with everybody. But what are the actual images they're seeing? I mean, in other words, if I was doing this right as just a designer, and they called me in, I would put, you know, placards all over the place with fairly ugly typography on it that says certain reminders about different things, right? That's not what I do. And I'd make videos that were like infomercials that you see on a plane.
Sure.
That's what I would imagine you think would be helpful if you didn't have a, you know, creative bone in your body. So so what is it actually, how does it manifest for you? What are these, what's on these videos? What's framed on the wall, or
All of the imagery includes bodies, human bodies, and normally engaged in either athletic or what I could call durational activity, you know, activity, strenuous activity inflicted on the body, but not in a masochistic way. You know, so athletic in the sense of the kind of grace and beauty of someone struggling to do something which needs training, needs practice, needs repetition, to actually be achieved, to actually be completed. These are things you see in the imagery. So in one particular example, when you walk into the lobby, there's a large four square layout. It's one large photograph, but it's actually divided into four squares within the single print. And you see a body with flotation devices that's on its back and is moving through a body of water. And so as that body's moving, the changes that occur are almost like looking at changes in constellations, where that body's proceeding across, you know, left to right through these different squares, and you see the changes created by the motion of that body as it moves through. Now, in truth, the way that photograph was made was that I worked with a guy named Colin Beatty, and I talked him into being thrown into Boston Harbor, and I dragged him behind a water taxi. And I worked out over the top of the water taxi and photographed him being tugged and being tugged backwards as he tried to turn himself back around frontward. So, you know, we could create potentially metaphors for how that that visual image works as a metaphor for addiction or dealing with addiction.
Yeah, it's beautiful, right? Beautiful. I mean,
certainly what someone sees when they walk into the space is a body in water and the shape shifting as it moves through that water. And so that it's, you know, I don't necessarily, I mean, maybe actually it's productive for that patient to know the conditions of production of the image. But thus far, I've mainly been concerned with the engagement of that patient with multiple images they move through the space and different types
right.
of...
Right. I don't think they need to know much about the production of it, or even whether it's art or not art. You know, it strikes me as a patient, you could come and then not to think that, you know, they're more sophisticated in what art is, but, you know, most of the world isn't, right? So, you know, if you see these, whether you recognize it as art or not, it seems like they would have a direct effect.
And I would love to see the ability for the work that's being generated, that I'm generating now, that where that's the site that I'm thinking about, or those sites, is the clinics that they're opening, but that work able to operate in a gallery or museum setting, if that's where it eventually goes, or if a copy of it goes into a different type of setting. And I don't know now if it can successfully do that, but I would like to see it be able to operate across those different types of venues, because you have different types of audiences and you get to learn and let the work feed back to you in different types of ways.
That's very interesting. I'm so glad we talked about that. And I think I want to spend the last part of this interview talking a little bit about the book you were talking about at the beginning of our discussion here on relational aesthetics. That's written collaboratively. And when was that coming out?
No, it's not. No, no, I'm writing it, and and certainly, if there's a lot of collaborative work that's featured in the book, but it should be coming out in 2016. We've been through a couple of editors, and you know, for me, coming out of you know, before I got involved in visual art production and performance art, I played in the indie rock band in Oklahoma and traveled around I-40 and I-35, and you know, played seedy beer bars and things, and you know, writing this book has been a lot like trying to make a record with an indie label, because it's, you know, the timing is very interesting, and sort of what producers want, editors want, versus what actually you think you need to do theoretically and as a argument, you know, they're often very different things. But I think what the book's going to be able to accomplish is maybe in part a bit of an introduction to practices that involve human people as part of the formal elements of art making. So in the same way that we might consider photographic materials or oil or bronze as material for art making, what happens ethically, what happens aesthetically when you consider human people in different parts of the world and engaged with artworks through different types of interface devices, whether that be physical interface or digital interface, you know, what does that do for us? What does that provide for us in terms of thinking about art production and the possibilities of aesthetic engagement, whether it be for politics or for pleasure, or you know perhaps for connoisseurship and collecting. And so I think the book's what I hope is that the book will do a good job at exploring that without being too dogmatic, and also highlighting artists. My own work, but also guys like Lee Walton, an incredible artist in London named Carrie Young, Matthew Backham, who's up at the University of Wisconsin, Colin Beatty, who's up in Boston, you know, highlighting the work of some of these people who are certainly not operating outside of the radar, but are outside of the purview of art history. And this would be a writing about art for artists and not necessarily for art historians. So it wouldn't be looking for a kind of judgment of aesthetic criteria, but really looking at a game plan or a training manual for how you can go out and do this and work in a dynamic way with contemporary art production.
Oh, that's exciting. I can't wait to read that book. By your definition, the question I just wanted to ask about how you describe that, and you do that so well, and that will really help for a lot of people, I think, who aren't even familiar with what the term means, and you outlined it pretty well there. I noticed that you're talking about human bodies. Wouldn't that encompass every form of theater as well into this, or no?
No, I think that's a great point. I think that, you know, relational aesthetics is, in a sense, I mean, I think what Nicholas Borio was working off of was on the heels of institutional critique, on the integration of performance art, and on the kind of, can I call it the sort of sex haze of installation inside museums and galleries. And in 1992, you know, they opened the Plaza Tokyo in Paris, and they opened it up as a space, almost like a beta space, like a workshop that really had no definition, but it had great real estate. And it was a way for him to showcase people that really didn't have an exhibition home because they were not working outside of objects and not working outside of performance or theater, but working with some kind of undefined or as of yet defined intermingling of those things. So certainly Rick Reit, Tier of Venezia, is a pretty well-known example of this, of the, you know, the gentleman who invites you to the gallery and will cook you a Thai curry dinner. And then after that, he's going to sell the utensils, et cetera. But it's the meeting and the engagement, the invitation, the planning, the coordination through the site with that particular audience that's, in a sense, just like theater, but in another sense, so unlike theater, because the expectations of the audience as they come into that space are normally for something very different, and they're expecting more of a passive, beholden engagement with a stay-at-art object, and instead, they've got a multidimensional, multisensual, time-based engagement with the space, the object, and the artist, and one another in the sense of the audience. And to actually theorize that, hopefully without over-formalizing it or becoming too dogmatic about it, I think it's a very exciting opportunity. And I think that people are doing it in their practices all the time, but maybe not really articulating what the objectives of that might actually achieve and why we might be doing this and why this kind of aspect of changing spectatorship to an active involvement with the aesthetic outcome of an artwork, what's different about that? What does that help us make possible? Because certainly we've got different tools available to us now. We've got different expectations in our audiences. And I think it's interesting as an artist to try to figure out what you want, but also what the work feedback feeds back to you based on what an audience does with you. And this creates lots of problems and lots of questions, but lots of excitement as well.
I love that. Well, I'm very much looking forward to the book. There'll be links to that and a number of other things in the interview text. Craig, I want to thank you so much for talking with me today. It's been a pleasure.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate you spending the time with me to talk about it.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.